Hi everyone, just a quick note before we start. About 4 minutes into this episode, Brady's recording software stopped working, and we only had the audio from our video call, although thankfully we had that. So the quality drops a little bit for 15 minutes or so. It's still totally listenable, and at around about the 19-minute mark, we get his local audio again. But apologies in advance for the change in sound, and get ready for a killer episode. Hello and welcome to the Musician's Map podcast. You know how every now and then, a band or an album just jumps out, grabs you by the neck, and demands your attention? Something about it just connects with you and is immediately added to your high rotation listening. There were a decent sized handful of those bands and albums for me last year, and one of them was an album called Maya by a band called Conjurer. The performance, the production, and the songwriting appealed to me in such a visceral way. It was almost immediately one of my favourite albums of last year. Conjurer have been around since 2014 and describe themselves as riff music. Others use metal terms like post, black, sludge, doom, death. Whatever they are, they've received endless accolades for the aforementioned Maya, and were easily one of the most celebrated bands of 2018 by critics and fans. They've been landing some pretty hefty festival shows and are poised to do some great things in the world of metal. So it's a huge honour to have co-guitarist, co-vocalist and band manager Brady Deepros join me on the podcast. And let me say, he really knocks it out of the park. We talk about forming a band, balancing music with your job, being self-managed, working with PR, signing to Holy Raw Records, vocal technique, spreadsheets, his strict approach to Conjurer, the years of hard work that slowly produces huge rewards, and The Darkness. You know, the glam metal band from the early 2000s. Here's Brady.
So I ended up playing cello for years, actually, and played in orchestras, ended up playing in Europe. It kind of became the thing that I did until my dad got me into The Darkness and I decided guitars were way cooler and wanted to learn guitar. So I started learning guitar at secondary school, which was age like 13.
Just a sec. Can I just stop you there? The Darkness was a gateway band for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's fucking amazing.
I've seen them like 13 times now. Wow. As well. I love The Darkness. That's so good.
That is so cool.
Yeah, I think Justin Hawkins is just the absolute man. Yeah. There's no denying that. First album as well, Permission to Land. People see them as a bit of a joke, but for me, it's the perfect British rock album. Yep. Just so tongue-in-cheek, but still with an emphasis on good songwriting, which is where I think bands should be putting the emphasis. Yeah. Lately, their material's got a little bit more focusing on, we're known for being a bit funny, so let's focus on that. First couple of records, though, spot on. Yeah, so The Darkness, that's usually the band where people are like, dude, what the fuck? You can't be listening to that. And I'm like, come on, sort yourself out. So yeah, so I got into that and was in a number of terrible metalcore bands and a pop-punk band. And then myself and Dan, the other guitarist, vocalist, started the band just through Facebook chatting. And I'd been a huge fan of his previous band. They're called Tear of Eden. That's tear as in like crying and then Eden as in the garden. They have an EP on Bandcamp, which you can still listen to, called As the Crows Watch Over Us. And it's fucking wicked. It's a metalcore band wanting to be a melodic death metal band and doing a reasonably okay job. But it's legitimately wicked. And I was a huge fan of them for years. And when they split up, it was like, oh my God, Dan from Tear of Eden, like, is talking to me and wants to start a band. Like, what the shit? Like, couldn't believe it. I was a fanboy when we started. We both were sick of being in metalcore bands, was pretty much the gist of that. And I just got into Gojira and the Black Dahlia Murder and was starting to explore more extreme music. And he was kind of a couple of years ahead of me, being a little bit older. And yeah, we bonded over not playing metalcore. Sure. Pretty much.
Yeah.
It developed from there. And we got Jan in, who's our drummer, who was the go-to drummer for any band in the Midlands for many years. It was like, oh, you want to play metal? Yeah, get Jan. Why? He's the guy that can play it. It was that simple. And he joined the band because he wanted some exercise. He didn't really like the music that much, but he was like, yeah, I don't have anywhere to practice drums, so if I'm rehearsing with you guys and it's going to be metal, then I'll get better, and kind of developed into enjoying the music.
Yeah.
We had a bassist before, our current guy, Connor, who was a friend of ours, Andy. And after we recorded Maya, Connor came in. It's actually really funny. In the first year or so, he used to come to all of our gigs and like essentially roadie for us. But like, we used to make him pay petrol money just to come with us and like carry our shit. Like, it was so bad looking back, but he'd been to as many gigs as the majority of us. So it was a really natural fit when he just came and joined the band.
Yep.
So that was quite cool. That was the genesis, as it were, of us getting together.
Yeah.
It's not a particularly wild story, actually. I don't think many bands actually are, unless you're looking for hype and to have some big narrative with your band. It's just guys get together and start playing some music.
Totally, man. You'd be surprised about how many people don't know how to start a band and struggle with actually just finding like-minded musicians, especially if you live in small towns, you know?
Yeah. I don't know what it's like in New Zealand, which I'm actually quite interested to find out about through this. But in the UK, it is such a small country that wherever you are, there is a scene nearby, whether it's good or bad. But like, so the town I live in, when I was getting into music, 20 minutes north or south, you got to either Rugby or Northampton, each of which had their own little metal scene. And then an hour north or an hour south, give or take, Birmingham or London, where there's the bigger scene. So the bands that do well locally, you kind of develop into, oh, we've got a gig in London or we've got a gig in Birmingham, and you kind of branch out like that. So we're very fortunate to live in a country where obviously there's a whole lot of heavy metal heritage. And for, again, outside of metal, I don't have a huge amount of experience, but I did play in a pop punk band, and the scene for that was really healthy as well. So there are definitely opportunities to play, and there's places to rehearse, you know, within a half hour drive of wherever you live.
Sure.
Pretty much. So yeah, we are quite lucky in that respect. I struggle to imagine what it's like in New Zealand because it's such a massive country in length. Like, if you were to drive like end to end, like,
yeah, it's long,
insane. Do you have like big scenes there, or how's it work?
Kind of. Like, we have a good metal scene. We've always had a really good metal scene across the country. Our three biggest cities, Auckland, Wellington, and Christchurch, you can live there quite happily and be involved in a scene. Our smaller cities will have small scenes, and our small towns, you kind of have to go to the smaller cities close to you. Similar yeah. thing to England. Obviously, there's not many people in New Zealand. We only have about 4.5 million, and a big chunk of those are in Auckland. So Auckland has the best scene. Metal is probably one of the strongest scenes. We used to have a really, really good hardcore scene,
yeah.
but that's kind of died off, and a really good punk scene, which has sort of died off. But the metal scene goes strong, and you know, it's one of those things where there's not really like a metalcore scene and a death metal scene and a black metal scene. It's just a metal scene.
Yeah, that's cool.
There aren't enough bands, so you'll get everyone sort of playing on the same bill.
Crazy mixed bills.
Yeah. So
that's awesome.
It is good. I live in a really small town, and it's about a 2-hour drive to Auckland. So quite often I'm up there for shows. But yeah, you kind of just have to travel, you know. When Conjurer come over to tour, you'll probably get 3 really, really good shows.
It seems people will do Australia and then stop off in New Zealand and yep. maybe on to like Japan or somewhere like that. So, or kind of vice versa. But
yeah.
if we get the opportunity to do either of the 3, I'd want to make sure that we do the other 2 as well.
Yeah, it's worth it, man.
I'd really like to get out there. We're going to America for the first time in a couple of months. We actually literally booked our flights about 2 hours ago.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, just the stress of planning international touring is really getting to me. Realizing how much effort actually goes into making this sort of thing happen, it's like, I've done it once now, so I've got the groundwork there to do it again. And the fact that for us, we're at the point where some of us having to quit our jobs to go out and do. So we're away for 6 weeks. And then when we get back, we've got a festival in the Netherlands and the next weekend. And then the weekend after that, 4 dates in Ireland. So we're out essentially for 2 months. And I was made redundant from my job last week. Our drummer's having to quit his job. the other two, it's kind of like 50-50. So we're at that point where it's like, well, fuck it, let's just go out and tour wherever and whenever we can. And you know, it's, well, yeah, again, we are very lucky in that respect that, you know, we're at a point in the lives where we can just do that.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, it takes a lot of hard work, and there's years of that kind of limbo where you're having to work a full-time job and then having to work full-time on the band at the same time, and then
it is a full-time job.
Beg your boss or whatever you're doing, you know, to be able to take enough time off work to go tour and then just come back to your job. And I think it gets pretty hard.
I'm getting to the point where I'm looking at part-time work, or if I do take on a full-time job, I'm going to stipulate that I need to be have flexible unpaid leave and to be able to move around my working days to fit around playing one-off shows and stuff like that. So we've got a couple of one-off festivals this year that I can't talk about yet, but we're going to need to take like a Thursday and a Friday off to get out there and things like that. So at the minute, the way I'm thinking and the way that it seems to be a lot of my friends who are in bigger bands, as in bigger than us, but not big enough to do it full time.
Yeah.
They all have numerous part-time jobs that allow them to, you know, I want to pick up a couple of shifts doing bar work this week and then get some driving work the week after to fit around these shows and vice versa. So I think gone are the days realistically within heavy music where, unless you're right at the top of the game, you can't be looking at it as a career. I am very confident that one day Kundra will be able to make enough money to pay ourselves a little bit. That is not going to be enough to supplement a full-time job. But if I've got four or five part-time jobs and my own little business on the side, plus a little bit of money from the band, then suddenly it's a lot more viable. And it's that kind of lifestyle is, I think, the way musicians are going to have to go going forwards. And
totally, man. And it's that diversification, isn't it?
Yeah,
and so
absolutely.
Lots of people in your situation, as you say, have their own business. They might do something else artistic and have an Etsy shop, or you know, there might be a tattooist, or there might be a sound engineer, or as you say, they might just drive vans.
Yeah.
I think that's the key, is multiple ways of generating an income when you're not actually out making money with the band.
Exactly. I'd like to get into touring, doing merch and tour managing and that kind of thing. It's something that I do for us anyway. So it's just getting the time to actually make it happen. I think that's the thing with most people. It's so daunting to take your band to the point where, so when we first started, we were doing 50 to 70 gigs a year up and down the length and breadth of the UK. Every single weekend we'd be playing shows, and we'd be doing weekenders just anywhere and everywhere even we could play.
Yeah,
we were doing it, and that in itself, to get to where we've got, we wouldn't have done that unless we'd played all these shows. And now it's like, well, we're starting to play bigger shows, and we've played with bands, you know, I remember playing with this band 2 years ago at a shit pub in the middle of nowhere to about four people. Now we're friends with them and they've invited us to come and play this show, or vice versa. And that networking from the very first few months of us playing has been so vital to getting us to where we are now. So I think people need to realize, if they want to do this and actually grow the band to an extent, that, well, that wasn't a goal for us, but it's got to the point, you know, it's happened. If that's something you want to do, then the first few years of really hitting it hard with playing shows is essential, I think. And it's something that not a lot of people can commit to. You know, it was really difficult for us, but you know, it's the only way, I think, unless you've got shitloads of money behind you, it's the only way you can really do it.
Yeah, it's that building your audience from the get-go, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
One show at a time, as you say. And when you've got four members as well, you know, it's trying to find everyone to get the time off work and to organize everything to actually get up there.
Oh, it's horrible.
Who's got the van?
Oh, none of us. So up until late 2018, we would take two or three cars to every show.
Oh, shit.
It was mad. And then we've got a couple of different drivers now. So when we do the bigger drives, we'll get someone to come drive us, basically. Our fees are just about high enough now to cover that.
Yeah.
And so we can actually, the band is at the point now where we don't actually have to put any money in ourselves as well.
it is completely self-sufficient, which is a point I never thought I would get to with a band.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just, I'm so used to it being just like a money pit that you throw all your money into and never see it again. So with regards to driving, I remember we did our first ever tour was with a band called Sodomized Cadaver from Wales. And they were nice guys. We did from where we are to Leeds, which is like 3 hours of 4 hours with traffic. And then we drove home to a shit town in the center of Wales, which was like a 5-6 hour drive. We stayed in a travel lodge. Our bassist drove home, worked 6 a.m. till 4 p.m. and then drove back to Wales to a town 20 minutes from the last town to play another show.
Fuck.
And these were shows to like literally like 10 people.
Yeah.
And we were getting paid like £50 fee, which is nothing.
Yeah.
Well, it's something, you know, it's better than we were expecting. But again, it's being willing to do stuff like that. Our first bassist, Andy, put in so many hours, and he had quite a high up like corporate job with a financial auditors. So he was literally Mr. Business, turned up for gigs in his suit and everything, and then just like rocked out. It was cool.
Yeah.
Not to try and discourage anyone, but it is a lot of work, but it is the most fun you will ever have. Like, yeah, as long as you can be prepared to go and play to no one and see it as a free practice, like, it's fun. And one of the gigs, our old manager, who was actually the bassist in quite a big UK band, he saw us when we played up north. We played a shit little showcase thing at a venue to five people, but he was one of those people, and we got chatting from then, and he ended up managing us and helped get us some festivals and stuff like that. So you never know who's going to be at those gigs, and chances are it's no one. But then, you know, we still get people coming to see us now that saw us in the, you know, 2015, people that were at our first few shows and have just relentlessly come to see us. And it's people like that that allow you to go on and play festivals and do, you know, all the cool shit that looks good on your Facebook page.
Yeah, and that's it, dude. Like, I was just about to say, what's the key to keeping up your morale and keeping up the desire when you're doing those 5 hour trips to play to five people for 50 quid and sleeping on a floor and repeatedly? But it is that. It's that it just builds upon itself. Those five people will come back next time that you come into town and bring all their friends.
As long as you're not shit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you're shit, there's you got a bit more problems, you know.
I think that the actual key to keeping it up is not looking at it like we're analyzing it now. I think we were literally just four guys. We had a renewed passion for the music we were making. We finally felt like we were making something that we could all be proud of, and music that actually got us really excited. Like, I remember with previous bands, I'd be like, oh God, I've got band practice tonight. Can't be bothered, I've had a long day at work. Whereas with Kundra, it was always like, fuck yes, let's go and do this. The motivation was there because of the music, and that is what allows you to go and play to no one, because you're like, I fucking love playing these songs, and I know that whoever is there is going to love it as well, because people feed on that, the passion from a band. I don't think, you talk about bands that are like crazy live with their performances, and yeah, that's also great, but you can get that from a band that stands there and does nothing if you see that passion. We're somewhere in between the two. We're not like jumping off the ceiling doing your escape plan, but we're not shoegazers either. It's getting that passion that you feel for the music across in your performance, and that is how we played Merthyr Tydfil to 10 people.
Yeah.
And it was wicked. Yeah, and I'd go back and do it again.
Yeah. That's so true, dude. That's so true.
That was crazy, actually. It was, we turned up 3 hours before sound check and accidentally crashed a funeral by driving into a church and had to reverse out really quickly while all these people were like staring at us. It was horrible. Sat in the rain for 3 hours, keep getting text from the promoter saying, yeah, doors are getting pushed back. And we were like, great, when can we load in? And we eventually loaded in, and it was just like a pub like just look like a. Do you have Weatherspoons in?
No, but I know Weatherspoons well. Yeah,
so like a standard chain pub. It just looked like a Spoons, and there was this family there, and they did not look like they were ready for an exchange. Yeah, it was a death metal gig at that point, and we were just sat there, like we all ordered a fry up. It was just like, cool, we'll just sit here and eat some food then. And this dude turns up about 10 minutes before doors were meant to be. None of the other bands had arrived yet. And he was like, oh yeah, I'm the sound man. We're like, fuck yeah, there is a gig on. And he pulls out this huge PA, like it was insane, pulls all the tables across. It actually ended up being a really cool gig. And apparently he's done sound for like Iron Maiden and Monsters of Rock back in the day. And I was of like, course. Shit, this guy. Yeah, it was cool.
But you self-manage the band now.
Yeah, so... you got to the point where I felt like there wasn't anything our management were doing for us that I couldn't already do or hadn't already done for us. And it got to the point where I was liaising with our PR guys and our label and all of this stuff pretty much on a daily basis. I would spend 70% of my day on my computer at work, on my Gmail, or like scheduling posts on Facebook, or just dealing with the band admin. So I got to the point where I felt like I was way more passionate about the project than our manager at the time. So we decided, and we were paying them a percentage of our fees as well, which kind of burnt a little bit while I felt I was doing the majority of the work. So we decided to not go in that direction, and I took it over. So it's something that I'm really passionate about. I don't write much music at all for us, so it feels like it's my way of contributing to the band.
Sure.
So I think everyone naturally falls into their own role within a band, but having someone to deal with this side of things, pretty much from day one, I was the guy that would talk to the promoters when we got to the show and make sure we got paid and kind of foster those relationships. And if it meant missing a few bands that we were playing with, it was like, well, okay, I've missed those bands, but I've met this guy and he's introduced me to this woman. And then we've, you know, those kind of relationships are the only way for your band to do anything other than your local scene.
Yeah.
It's just talking to these people. So that I adopted pretty much from day one. So it's felt like taking on management has been a little bit inevitable, and I've had the time realistically to focus on it. And there is always something going on over email every single day. I'm talking to our PR guys, hold tight, are insanely good. I cannot, if you're a UK band that needs PR, talk to Matt Benton at Hold Tight. They've gone above and beyond anything we could have ever hoped. I get daily emails pitching things, working on things. You know, I can contact them at any hours, and they pretty much always get back to me. So it's having that kind of support. I'm kind of going on a bit of a tangent here, but we were playing at 2000 Trees Festival this year. Which, have you been to many UK festivals where you lived over here?
Yeah, I've been to loads. Yep.
Sick. Okay, so 2000 Trees, for anyone not in the know, is a primarily alternative kind of rock festival. So they had Twin Atlantic headline this year. They've got You Me at Six and Every Time I Die, and it's a mixture of kind of like alternative rock and then a bit of metal, bit of hardcore, a bit of everything. We played there, and the merch tent was run by a label called Big Scary Monsters, who are a really good UK alternative label. And their boss, Kev, was saying to me, whatever you do with your band and whoever you work, make sure that you surround yourself with people that you implicitly trust to get things done, and that you can say, hand on heart, you know they've got your best interests at heart, and you know that they will work as hard as you will on the band. And this was the point at which I felt that I should take over the management, because that felt like the one kind of weak link in the chain. Sure. So we have Hold Tight, who do our PR. Our label are Holy Raw Records, who are the best record label in the UK for extreme music.
from the minute they started working with us and they kind of plucked us out of nowhere before we released our EP, they have been so supportive and they have insane ideas that they're always running by us. They are creative, they're passionate, and if they work with a band, it is because they 100% believe in you and they show that. Mm. When we first got picked up and we were thinking, okay, you know, we'll be a little side note for them. They'll put out the EP and we might get a couple of emails from them, but you know, fine, we're happy to be here. It was every day for months we were talking, and they throw everything into every release they do. So it's having both of those two people working in tandem has done more good for this band than anything I could have done.
So Holy Roar picked you up for your EP.
Yeah.
That was your debut EP.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
We had a lot of songs written, and as opposed to doing an album, we felt an EP would be a good kind of foot in the water just to get something out there. We had most of the songs that are on Maya written, or we picked four that we felt would work well as an EP, kind of cohesively, and went to track them with Steve Sears, who is a producer at Titan Studios in Watford, and he did the Gallows record, Desolation Sounds, and the Hang the Bastard, Sex in the Seventh Circle records, at which we both were huge fans of those records. So we went to track with him, and Lewis Johns ended up mixing and mastering the EP. Lewis is, I would say, the in-house producer for Holy Roar Records. He did so many of last year's records, Employed to Serve, Rollo Tomasi, Svalbard. He's just done Renounced. He's done the forthcoming Employed to Serve record. You know, it seemed for a while that as soon as Holy Roar released something, it was Lewis Johns on the production. So he actually hit us up and said, I'd love to work with you. And we were like, well, actually, we've got an EP that needs mixing. So that was purely serendipitous that he happened to contact us. And he really liked us, really liked the record. And he obviously knows Holy Roar really well through that. So we'd been pestering Holy Roar on Twitter with our shit self-recorded demos. And Alex told me they'd listened to them and said, yeah, kind of interesting, but, you know, it sounds like shit and there's nothing there.
Yeah.
Lewis sent them the record and said, check this band out. And Alex really liked us. And it was as simple as getting an email from him saying, I'd like to put your EP out.
Sweet.
And we were like, shit.
Yeah, rad.
And it was while we were recording that we kind of really got into Holy Roar. So we were watching videos of Svalbard and Employed to Serve while we were in the studio, and it was like one of those, maybe one day, like 10 albums down the line, Holy Roar will be interested in putting our stuff out. And it was a real, like, the very first, like, holy shit, what's going on moment for us when they got in touch. But Alex was saying, and this is something I think that goes for all people within the industry, for them to check out a band, there's almost no point just tweeting them or emailing them with your music. They need to hear about you from their friends, from other people in the industry. They need to see your name on posters. That ideally, they need to see you at a gig supporting one of their bands. Like, it's only when you get three or four of those things all happening in tandem that they kind of go, okay,
yeah,
maybe it's worth checking this out.
Yeah.
I get a lot of people say, oh, you know, can you send my stuff to Holy Roar, or how did you guys get picked up on the label? It's like, well, you need to try and get in front of them without putting yourself in front of them, as in, you know, directly saying, yeah, look at us, sign us, we're great. There's no point. Every band thinks they're great. It's not until other people start saying it that they're gonna, you know, you think about the amount of submissions any label or PR company or anything gets. And that similarly, there's a really good article put out by our PR company, which is, how do I know if I need PR? And it just kind of takes you through the steps of, have you done all of this? Have you got to this point? At that point, then you should start to look for that kind of representation. So
rather than approaching record labels, you should just focus on working really hard at your music. And when you're ready to sign to a label, labels will probably be already approaching you.
Yeah, I think that's true. And there's a lot to be said for record labels. We were fully prepared to self-release the EP and just get out there and try and get some many people. You look at a band, are you familiar with Frontera?
Yeah.
Yeah, so those guys, for anyone not so in the know, are another UK insanely heavy band, but everything they do is self-release, all through Bandcamp, and they have a huge following. That, you know, they do festivals, they do everything, and that is because they have this ethos, which the way I approach the band is very much how I'm assuming they do, which is quality over everything else. So quality over profit, quality over ease. Like, we print all of our merch on Gildan Ultra, which is the more expensive version of the standard heavy, which is what everyone uses.
Yeah.
Because they are nicer quality shirts and they last longer. And we use a company called Pins and Knuckles, who are amazing and international, who do all of our merch printing. They print a higher quality of print, and we go to reputable people to design our merch and our artwork and stuff like that. Because, yeah, and you know, we pay very good money to get that done, because what that equates to is, 3 years after you've released a t-shirt, you still see people wearing it. I get messages from my friends when they go to festivals, and they're like, I've seen like 15 people wearing your band's t-shirt today. And it's like, well, yeah, because that is the one out of their closet that hasn't faded, and the design has stood up well, because it's been, you know, there's been a lot of effort put into it. And I've spoken to people in bands that have been like, oh yeah, we paid like 50 quid to get our merch design. And I was like, dude, we spent like £300 on a long sleeve design recently, and we've sold an insane amount of them. You know, it's the effort and the money that you put into things is directly related to the success of those things. And with regards to songwriting, we will write and rewrite and rewrite again a song until it's perfect. And then we will rehearse it until we're absolutely sick of it. And it's only then that you start to get that reputation for consistency, which I think is the most important thing. I've been in bands before where the singer's been like, well, I'll design the t-shirts and I've got a mate that will print them really cheap. And it's like, wicked. We have 100 t-shirts and it's cost us £200. But they're crap and people don't actually want them. You get a few people that will buy them because they like your band and they want to support you or your mates, but you're not actually giving people something that's worth their money. And until we have to, we won't charge more than £10 for a t-shirt, because we don't need to. We don't make much money on that, but we have been at gigs and you see like £25, £30, £40 for a t-shirt. And it is, I know whoever's taking a cut of that, I know you don't need to charge that much. Yeah. And it's that principle. And people are like, how do you guys sell so much merch? It's like, well, we make it really good and we make it as cheap as we can. There's no like secret formula to it. And
you're representing yourself, you know, you're representing the band in all of these different ways.
Exactly.
Your music videos, your recordings, your merchandise, everything. And if they're shit, if any aspect is shit, it represents the band in that way.
Exactly.
And so as a music consumer, as a music fan, when you're looking around for new bands, if something stands out as being really good quality, whether it's, you know, the songwriting, the artwork, whatever, you're immediately a little bit more drawn to that because people want to be associated with that good quality product, right?
Yeah, exactly. I feel like it's such an obvious thing for me. It's been since day one, but the amount of bands that I see that have just put seemingly like no care or attention into one of those aspects. When we were saying before we went to the studio, we would rather wait 6 months and lose all of our momentum if it meant that we could save up to record a record that sounds as good as we need it to.
Yeah.
It's just such a no-brainer.
Yeah, but it comes down to that money though, right?
Yeah.
That's where people stumble. They don't want to spend, you know, £5,000 on a recording. They want to spend
$500.
No one does. I mean, and like, I've done it a couple of times, and you know, you don't want to do it, but It just comes down to that. Most people, they don't want to go and spend £300 on a t-shirt design. They want to spend 50.
Yeah.
It's just if you're prepared to work, to save, to sacrifice that money for the band.
Exactly. That's what it was. It was the amount of money we put in. We never kept track of it. And I'm so glad because it'd be such a depressing statistic if I found out how much money I've put into this band from day one. But again, none of it was wasted because if you love your music and you love performing live and that is your hobby and you see it as your hobby, then justifying paying for it isn't an issue. You get people that will go out and spend hundreds of pounds on Warhammer or remote control cars or whatever their thing is. That's their thing. If your thing is being in a band, then you need to invest in that. Yep. It means paying to practice every week. We practice every single week. Still, and we have done since we started. It was 3 hours a week for the first 2-3 years. Now it's 2 hours a week because we're pretty much just going over the same set list. But we pay for that every week, and we used to pay for studio time, petrol. And when you're first gigging, you know, it's like you don't get any money. You get a little bit of money to cover your petrol. You certainly don't get any food or anything like that. But it's your hobby, and it's only in the last year or so that we've 2018 I say was comfortably where we didn't have to pay for our own petrol money. We didn't have to pay for most of the time. We don't have to pay for our own food at shows. And suddenly, oh, okay, we're doing a lot more, so it's taking up more time. We're earning less money, but it's costing us less money as well.
Sure.
So as you grow, those kind of benefits do become apparent. It's still difficult, and but it does get easier. And you do, as long as you're genuine, and I think if it's really obvious when people are just chasing fame, no, you wouldn't be doing this kind of music if you're chasing fame, but you know, if you're just chasing that sort of thing and you're not doing it because you fucking love it, then it is obvious to people, and it becomes a little bit sad, I think. But if you're genuine about it and you have good quality control, then you can get to the point where it's a hobby that doesn't really cost you that much, which is amazing. And then you start to play abroad and you're like, oh no, shit, now it's really expensive. Don't worry about it.
When did you start working with Hold Tight?
Hold Tight did the PR on art.
And was that at the advice of Holy Raw, or was that just you guys?
So Holy Raw do their own PR, except for bigger releases or if they're really busy. So Holy Raw did the PR for our EP, and we started working with Hold Tight a few months before the album came out. And that was, we wanted to go with an external PR agency just because we wanted to give it a bit more of a push. And not that we didn't think Holy Raw could have done it, and they've done really well, but they'd just done the Helpless record, which got in like the Daily Sport, which is a massive like UK newspaper that should not have a grindcore record in it. But so Hold Tight did a really insanely good job with them, and Holy Raw used them anyway, so it felt like a solid plan.
Yeah.
We were actually advised against going with them. They felt like the right people to go with to us, and we spoke to them a lot, and it felt right. Our label, who we did trust, said go for it. So we started working with them, and immediately it was all hands on deck, and they were much more reasonable than a lot of the other quotes we'd had in for PR.
Is that like a monthly commitment, or is it a percentage commitment? What sort of thing is it?
It works on, I think it's different for everyone.
Yep.
They originally did it per month for the album campaign, and actually it ran over a little bit, so they did us a deal on that. And now they charge us, because we've said, regardless of what happens, we work with you going forwards now. So they are now doing kind of like festival season, and then we'll put together an invoice for a tour or a couple of tours. So they are very much catered to the size of your band, the amount of work needed, and then the amount of activity you've got. So it's not like there is a blanket price that we will charge Slipknot and we will charge your local pub covers band. They're much smarter about it than that, which is nice. And it feels like to get to that point, they have to really evaluate everything about your band and know what the plan is, kind of where it's going to go, what they're expecting. So there's a lot of effort that goes in before you start working with them, which is, again, really nice. Little things like this podcast, I get an email from them saying, you've been asked to do this, do you want to come get involved? And and this is outside of a period that we're really working with them. So they've kind of kept up to date and will still filter bits and bobs for us. So I've sucked them off quite a lot so far. But when you get to a certain point, I think that the benefits of a really good PR person far outweigh the costs. Yep. Just above and beyond, just any of the press coverage.
Which you guys have had a ton of press coverage as well.
Yeah.
They did an incredible job.
Yeah, it's been crackers.
It comes down to what you were saying before about the advice you received to work with people that you trust, that feel right.
Yeah, exactly.
I know I've been in situations where I've worked with people and maybe there's been something just nagging in the bottom of your gut and you're like, this doesn't feel 100%. Like everything on the surface looks really good, but it doesn't really feel like 100%. And then, what do you know? Eventually, you know, something comes out. And yeah.
Every time I've had that feeling about anything, it's been whether it's you get offered a tour or you get asked to do a show and you're like, this seems cool, but this promoter's been a bit weird. Every time they're weird. Like, yeah. and I think people's like online manner will get people that will send us an email that says, can I book your band? And I will reply saying, please contact our booking agent because his details are on the Facebook where you obviously got this email address from. And then they'll say, cool. And then they'll send me a personal message on Facebook, say, oh, did you get my email? I'm trying to book your band. And then they'll send the band a Facebook message saying, I'm trying to book your band. Can you? And it's like, that is the kind of stuff that makes people think, I don't want to work with you because wait for a reply. Give people a week to get back to you and send a formal follow-up that doesn't say sent from my iPhone on the bottom and just have a load of random spam on it. Like, if people want to work with you, whether that's a band contacting a label, a band contacting a promoter contacting a band, anything you do, send a formal email and then follow up formally like a week later. There's just, that is something that I learned because I used to pester people all the time and wonder why I didn't get replies.
Sure.
And then it was only through experience and learning that myself, it's like, oh, okay, that's actually really annoying for people.
Yeah, the people are professionals and actually have a lot of work to do and you can't just, you know, constantly be on the ball answering everything now. Yeah,
exactly.
So, dude, what's next for Conjurer? I mean, you guys have obviously just been through a huge growth period and you've been doing loads of shows and now you've, I guess, you're booking festivals and tours for upcoming summer?
Yeah. So we've never really done any headline shows. So we're doing 4 headline shows next month. So that'll be really cool. It's quite nerve-wracking for us because we still don't feel like we've got enough clout to do a headline show. I still like, whenever we talk about it, I'm like, yeah, but is anyone going to turn up? Like, does anyone care? Like, so we're doing that. Our first show of the year is next week with Milk Teeth, who are grunge alternative band on Road Runner.
I saw that lineup and thought it was strange.
So yeah, we're doing the show with Milk Teeth. Headline show is Complexity Fest, which is a tech metal festival essentially based in the Netherlands, which again, we love just playing all these like crazy bills. And then we go to America for a month, which is
a logistic. So rad.
Yeah. So it's 34 shows in 39 days.
Yes.
We have never played more than 9 shows in a row, so I have no idea how my voice is going to cope.
Yeah, I was just going to say, how are your voices going to hold up on that?
Our last tour was November, and we did 9 shows, and it was the first time neither of us had lost our voice in a run of shows, so I think we're starting to get the technique down where we're not damaging ourselves, which is nice. My plan at the minute is just not to think about it and then just do it.
Yep.
So I know it's not a very sensible way to deal with it, but...
Do you do coaching or anything for your vocals, or do you work on your sort of technique in that way?
I didn't to start with. We just didn't want to get anyone else in the band, so we decided to do it. Neither of us had done vocals before. I used to lose my voice quite a lot, and you slowly start to work out what works for you and what doesn't. And then when we played Euroblast, this guy was like, I'm doing free heavy vocal coaching. Do you want me to do a session? And we were like, fuck yeah. So he came and hung out in the van with us and did a lesson on false chord vocals, which have been,
yeah,
I think, beneficial. Like, again, since that, neither of us have really struggled with our voice as much. And I still haven't nailed the technique, but it seems to be working. Yeah. And then I thought, I've got a massive spreadsheet, which is our upcoming shows. Oh, yeah, it's got a list of every show we've ever done on it as well, which is quite nice. And I keep a list of like all the bands that we've played with and everything. So awesome. All the sport bands.
Like, oh, I love that. That's organization, man.
My mate, Google Documents is my best friend in the world. Like, we use it for everything. Like, our spreadsheet here. Let me talk you through this. I don't think anyone's... I've never talked about this in an interview before.
I've had that exact spreadsheet.
Oh, man. Yeah, so I've got date, what day of the week it is, city, venue, what the event is, whether it's been confirmed, whether it's been announced, number of advanced sales if I'm promoting it or if it's a headline show, entry cost, link for advanced tickets, link for the Facebook event page, what gear we need, what time loading is, sound check, our set time... doors, curfew, fee, commission on our fee to our booking agent, what rider there is, if there's accommodation, guest list, what bands are playing, who the promoter is, and their contact details.
Holy shit, dude. That's so incredible. Oh, listen up, people. That's the way.
Yeah. So if someone in the band says what's happening for the next few months, I just say check the spreadsheet and they go in. And then it's got like for other shows, it's got another tab with... if you need anyone on the guest list for a show, you add them on there. And then when I get to the venue, I just look on the spreadsheet. So this is the guest list.
Yeah.
Any dates someone's unavailable for a show. And then I link to all the past shows, which was first show was 1st of February 2015.
Wow.
But yeah, that spreadsheet has been an absolute lifesaver.
And is there anything, any kind of advice that you'd give to musicians starting out, especially in bands, maybe especially in metal bands, that we haven't kind of covered?
The main thing is work with people you trust. And I think especially when you're rehearsing, when you first start, you don't know a song until you know every individual part. We'll get into a practice and say, right, go from the third bridge of Behold the Swine, click, 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 and we play it. You need to know every aspect of every song inside out, play it to death until you're absolutely fucking sick of it, because then you can focus on your performance. When you're just playing a song kind of from instinct, that is when you can work on your performance. And I see so many bands where, or I've played in bands as well, where I know, is the drummer going to get this fill and are we going to go out of time, or am I going to remember this solo? And whereas Kundra, it is like, I know every single person is going to nail every single part of every single song. I don't even need to think about it. I can just enjoy playing it. And we did not get to that point straight away. It took a couple of years, and really we should have rehearsed more. But if you can get as close to that point when you're starting off as possible,
yeah,
it will put you in so much better stead for going forwards. And don't settle for anything less than exceptional. If you don't hear something or see something and think, fuck, that's amazing, that is exactly what I wish my favourite band was doing, then by all means, go ahead and do it, but don't expect other people not to have a reaction like that if you don't have it yourself.
Yeah.
Whenever we do something new, I think, fuck, this is wicked, and get really excited about it. And that is the only way you can expect people to have any passion for your project. The passion comes from you first, and then hopefully other people.
Dude.
And if it doesn't, don't complain. Just keep doing it, because if you've got that passion there, it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks, because you're having a great time.
Yeah.
And that's all for this episode. A giant thank you to Brady for being so awesome and sharing so much on the podcast. Make sure to check out Conjurer. You'll find links to all their pages in the podcast description and on the Musicians Map website. Brady chose two artists of the week. The first is God Complex, and the second is Press D'Amico. You'll also find links to their music in the podcast description. So I hope you all enjoyed that episode. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to like the podcast on whatever medium you listen to. Share it around with your friends. That's probably the most important thing. Share it with other musicians and people that you know. Share it with your bandmates. The more people that can get this advice and information, the better. And make sure to leave a review if you do that kind of thing. And look out for the next episode coming very soon. I've already lined up a couple of amazing guests. So more Musicians Map in the pipeline. Talk soon. This podcast and the website musiciansmap.org is dedicated to sharing knowledge and advice about music and the music industry. It's all about community, honesty, and positive progress. The experiences, stories, and advice shared on the podcast are given freely with the hope that you can relate to them and benefit from them. If you've found this podcast enjoyable or useful, make sure to check out the Musicians Map ebook and audiobook about building success in music. You'll find it at musiciansmap.org/books, Amazon, and Audible. And buying a copy of the book directly contributes to the continuation of this podcast. There's also a free ebook, How to Get Your Music Heard. Go to musiciansmap.org/free-book to get your copy. If you have a suggestion for the podcast or for the YouTube channel, or you just want to get in touch and say hello, please do so via the Musicians Map Facebook group or by email at kane@musiciansmap.org. Thanks for listening and stay positive.